Thank you very much. Today is Daf Chet, the eighth page. We hope by the end, so we have expectations set. My hope is to get down on Daf Chet Amud Bet to the end of the dark yellow section, Kamash Malan, right before Hakol Golan. That's what we'll pick up next week. We're starting, I hope everybody has access to Daf Zayin too. We're going to start Zayin Amud Bet at the bottom with the Mishnah. And to set up the theme of this page and where we're up to. We stated last week, and you should feel free to disagree with anything I say at any point, that, thank you, the theme that emerges out of the whole first chapter generally is that justice is approximate on earth. The way we adjudicate cases, the way we mete out punishment is as close as we can get, but we acknowledge from the outset there will be mistakes. In the sense that it won't be historically that every time somebody is punished, they strictly did what they deserved. Sometimes accusations happen that we can't disprove, and it's beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's the way it goes. That's what comes out of the first perek. What comes into the second perek, we suggested, which I'm going to be happy to shift as we go along, because I can't, you know, prepare the whole thing ahead, so we're kind of shifting a little bit as we go along, is essentially two themes. The first is, so how do we ensure justice? If justice is approximate, if accusations can be made that we can't disprove and conniving people are capable of toying with the system, how do we ensure justice? So the first response is high social awareness. We all have a responsibility as citizens, and in many ways, this chapter becomes political theory in the sense that we are morally responsible to be aware of each other's needs. That's the first thing. Justice is almost a kind of last resort. We don't want to go to court if we can avoid it. First instinct isn't, I'm going to sue you. My first instinct is, what can I do more? What can you do more? How can we deal with this outside of the courtroom? So the first part of this paragraph has put a lot of attention on intention. What it means to be negligent, what it means to be unintentional, how much awareness do I have to have, at which point we'll then pivot to the point I started with last week, which is, this seems untenable. I have to live with such high, hyper-attentiveness to my neighbors, I'd rather just live in a cave where I don't have to pay attention and I can throw knives at the wall as much as I like and I can juggle and I don't have to care. So the second thrust of this chapter is going to be why we need each other. Why being together with other people is part of the human condition. So we're forced into a place where we have to be hyper-attentive because justice is approximate. So the conceptual hurdle I had to spend some time trying to overcome over the course of Shabbat, which I'm still not confident I have to my satisfaction, that's not because it's impossible, just I could also have brain fog, is that there is a massive gap between the crime of murder and the crime of manslaughter. And it's not the gap I would do. If I were to tell you, what do you think the difference between murder and manslaughter is, what might you say?
Intention.
It's just intention. So what we're going to have to uncover today is that that's not strictly speaking true. There is another dimension. And I'll say what I think the bottom line will be, and hopefully that'll become clear. Murder is a metaphysical crime. Doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter where you are, if I take your life, I've committed a crime against the cosmos, a crime against humanity, and I've cost a life. Manslaughter is not a metaphysical crime, it is a social crime. It is a breach of contract to those who I've made either an explicit or an implicit agreement to live with. And this is going to become clear in the case that we'll get to in the Mishnah, which is, if somebody comes into my house, I walk home, I open the door, I come into my living room, and someone's sitting there. And I know they're no threat to me at all. Either they can't move, or I know I'm stronger than them, or they explicitly say, I'm not here to threaten you, I just love this chair, I've been dreaming of it all week, I came here for lunch last Shabbos, and I sat in, I just had to come back and sit in the chair. Am I allowed to kill them? However much I want to, if I kill them, is it murder? Yeah, but it's my house. Doesn't matter. It's a metaphysical crime. You've cost a life. Doesn't matter who, where, context is absolutely irrelevant. If I'm in my house and I am juggling knives because I enjoy it, and accidentally a knife falls and it kills somebody on my couch. If they have permission to be in my house, that's manslaughter. If they don't, it's not. And I've expressed the same level of negligence, same level of inattentiveness. I wasn't paying attention to who's there, and I was lucky that they didn't have permission to be in my house. But the context is absolutely, I've had a social agreement that I've invited you into my home, so I have to pay attention to you. But if I didn't invite you into my home, I have no such agreement with you. So the crime is really a social crime when it comes to manslaughter. So that's how we begin, again, with the focus on hyper-attentiveness to those we live with. And that's distinct from murder, which is treated in Sanhedrin and elsewhere, which is really just a metaphysical crime rather than a social crime. If that's not clear, hopefully it'll become clearer as we go through the daf. Let's begin. At the bottom of the page, Zayin Amud Bet. This is the second mission of the Perek. The first mission of the Perek was, for want of a better reference, a Les Mis opening. Anyone know the first song, Les Mis? Look down. So Derech Yiridato is what the first mission establishes. Is that it's, oh, there you, look down, look down. So that's, if you wanted to summarize the first mission, that's what the first mission is. Anything Derech Yiridato, if you're lowering a barrel, if you're pushing a roller on the roof, if you're descending a ladder, if something is going down and an accident happens, you're in trouble. Which we said last week may have homiletical political overtones, that this is about people in power being aware of those who have less power, or just making sure that you look down. Because it doesn't strictly speaking make that much sense. That if I'm climbing a ladder and I fall off, or I'm going down a ladder and I fall off, is there more negligence at psychological level in going down than up? I mean, to some degree, maybe, because if you're going down anyway, you're going with gravity, so you should be a bit more sensitive. It's also that what's happening around and below us is important. That's the first mission. Now we come to the second. And the focus of this mission is going to be unintended consequences. Something's a little less direct than you fell or you dropped. Mishnah. Nishmat HaBarzel Mikito. If you have your axe and you're chopping away, and the blade of the axe, is that what it's called? The blade of the axe flies off while you're chopping. Vaharag, and it kills somebody. This is like a very vivid graphic image, but for some reason in high school we just talk about this like it's normal. Like, oh yeah, an axe flew off and it killed someone. Rebbe Omer Eino Galus. Rebbe says, you do not go to Galus. And there's so much ambiguity in this parak when it says you don't go to Galus. Well, why not? Is it because it was completely accidental, or because it was too intentional? So our assumption here is going to be, it's too intentional. Meaning if you're holding an axe, it's got a loose blade on it, and you just start whacking away and it flies off, that's kara of lemezid. You didn't mean to kill them, but you should have checked the axe wasn't loose before you started whacking away at it. V'chachamim omim gola. The chachamim say, no, that's negligence. You don't have to check every blade every time you start wielding it. If it was good last time, it was good last week, and you've used this axe for a long time, but you didn't check, that's accidental. Not accidental, that's unintentional, that's negligence, so you do go to Golas. Again, this is not to say you're off the hook. It's to say that you violated the social contract to pay attention in this case, because you didn't check it. So you do have to check. It's not intentional, but it is a social contract that you have to do. And if you don't, you get exiled. Mina eitz amit bakea. But if you're chopping away and a piece of wood, a splinter, shoots off and, you know, flies into someone's heart or neck, and that's the end of them, vaharag, Rebbe omer golet. Rebbe says you go to Golas, meaning that's unintentional, meaning I don't know how you can control for that. In theory, could you control? I guess it's a physical calculation. It's not random. It's random if you don't pay attention, but you can aim in a way that you've been exceptionally careful. Nothing ever flies off, I assume. There's a science to it. It's not just random. So he says, you have to check. Chachamim says, no, that's an unintended consequence. You start hacking away at a tree and a splinter flies off. You can't help that. You can't plan for that. It's a complete accident. And the chances of you hitting there and a thing flying off and it landing in their neck and them being in that spot, it's preposterous to imagine you have to live your life on tenterhooks like that with that kind of attention. That's what the Chachamim suggest. Tanya Amalehem into the Mishnah, the Gemara. The Gemara says, there was a teaching, Rebbe Chachamim, that the Rebbe shared with the Chachamim, and the Rebbe seems to think you have to have more attention. Meaning if the handle flies off, you go to Golas. And if a splinter flies off, you don't because, sorry, if a handle flies off, you don't go to Gullis because it's too intentional. And if a splinter flies off, you go to Gullis because it's still negligent. So they say to the Chachamim, who seem to have a lower threshold, it says in the Pasuk, if the barzel flies off of the wood, makes it sound like you go to Gullis if the handle knocks wood off the tree. That's his claim. Vahalolo neema elimina eitz. It says that it comes off of the wood. Va'od neemar eitz lamaz v'neem eitz lamala. And in the verses, the passage of verses, it speaks about wood a lot. It says if you go to chop wood and then the axe flies off the wood, it says the wood twice. So what's the first wood talking about? If you go to chop wood, what's that wood talking about? Talking about the handle or talking about the log? Yeah, so if you go to chop wood and the handle and the axe causes the wood to fly, that sounds like it's talking about the log, not the actual handle itself. So both cases, it seems reasonable, Rebbe is saying. I'm not suggesting you need to be hyper-attentive just on the basis of instinct. I'm reading the Psukim, Rebbe says, and the Psukim seem to indicate that when you're chopping wood, if wood flies off the log, that's enough negligence for you to be in trouble. And Rav essentially responds by saying, the Chachamim also reading the same Pasuk. They're not turning around and saying, I think that's too high a threshold by instinct. I'm reading the Pasuk. Shnei Mikra Echa Darshu, they're reading the same Pasuk. It says, V'nashal ha-barzel min ha-eitz. And this is a kind of a classically ambiguous verse. The nashal means flies off, but it can be read as causes to fly or flies off. So V'nashal ha-barzel, if the iron flies off the wood, that seems to be the handle fly, the blade flies off. You could read it, v'nashal ha-barzel, and the barzel causes to fly, min ha-eitz, from the wood. So it could be read either way. So how do you pick? Rebbe savar, yesh em l'masoret. Rebbe says there is preference to tradition, meaning the text, the way the text is written and handed down. And the text itself, v'nishel kativ, and it says the word v'nishel, which is not strictly speaking true, it doesn't have a yud in the verse. But he's saying, by default, that three-letter root in this context, you would imagine to be a PL. And for those of you familiar with grammatical formulations, PL is like an active. Different between shamar and shimer. And it's a much more active. And he says, in the context here, it should be v'nishel. That's what the word should be read as. Of Rabbanan Savar and the rabbis say, yeshem l'mikra, the way we pronounce it is more important. V'nashal karin, and we read it in the passive kal tense, which means to fly off on its own. So they're both just applying a different standard, a different reading lens to this verse. Is it in the pshat talking about the handle flying off, the axe flying off the handle, or is it talking about a splinter flying off the log? They're both just, depends on whether you go by tradition or whether you go by how it's read today. And if we could go down somewhat of a rabbit hole and say, even the idea of hyper-attentiveness to your surroundings, what's that debate here? In that, do you pay attention just to the text or to how we read it as a community? And if it's about how we read it as a community, it's more about social attention and social contract as opposed to just strict legislation. But the Gemara says, "Rebbe Yeshem Masoret Sviralu." Does Rebbe really say we prefer going with the text rather than how we read it by tradition over the page? V'am Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yehuda ben Yosef, Rabbi Shammai, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yekiva, Kol Hu Sviralu Yeshem Lamikra. That's the fastest three lines we can get through. That we're told they all hold Yeshem Lamikra, not the Masoret. So why are you saying that Rebbe in this case says that we go with the text rather than pronunciation? Hanu de Kamaluva, oh, that's why he gave two reasons. He said, look at the text. And he says, also look at the larger context where it says, if you go to chop wood and then the wood flies off, it's obviously talking about the log. So it's not just that he prefers tradition. Full stop. Second conceptual response to the Mishnah is coming now, which is why it's in a different color, which is if you are concerned, as Rebbe is, for unintended consequences, meaning he says, if you chop and a splinter flies off, you're in trouble. You have to go to Gullis. And the Chachamim say that's too disconnected. That's too unintended consequence. So we say, how far does this go? If Rebbe thinks unintended consequences, what happens if I chop something? And had anyone seen these YouTube videos that people have spent hours and hours setting up dominoes and then a marble hits something and then it flies and it shoots through a hoop and it's like very impressive. But the chances of that happening unintentionally are quite low. So what happens if it happened unintentionally? It still came from me. I started the dominoes falling. So Amar Rav Papa says, Mandashada Pisa Ledikle, if somebody throws a clod of earth at a date tree. Va'ata tamre, and it kind of severs the date bunch. Va'azal tamre v'katal, and the dates fall and kill someone. You know, that's a bad morning. You think I'm just throwing a clump of earth at a tree? Why would you do that? Why not? I want to throw a clump of earth at a tree. And by mistake, it falls down and kills someone. Rav Papa says, Banu Machlokes de Rebbe Rabbanan. He says, this is the same debate as Rebbe and Rabbanan. Chopping wood, a splinter comes off, throwing clod of earth, and a date palm falls down. Can you think of any reason to say those are not the same? Rav Papa's saying it's the same thing. I do an act, and there's something that flies off. I chop wood, splinter flies off. I throw earth, dates fall down. Rebbe says you're in trouble, you've got to go to Galz Nechama and say you're not. Is there a difference between those two instances you can think of, between chopping wood and a splinter flying, or throwing earth and dates falling?
Well, you had a purpose in chopping the wood, whatever it was.
So I had a purpose in throwing the earth, whatever it was.
What is more attenuated?
Really, it's sort of a random...
So let's say I was not preparing the wood for my hearth. I love chopping wood. I mean, I don't have a fire at home. I just am really sentimental about fairy tales.
One seems more attenuated than the other. In other words, if you assess percentages, I would say that the chances of the blade flying off of wood are higher than if you're throwing a piece of mud at a tree.
The blade or the splinter?
Sorry?
The splinter or the blade flies off? Meaning, we're not talking about the blade, we're talking about if you hit and a splinter flies off.
Splinter.
So you're saying that's more likely?
More likely than a date tree falling off.
Inherent risk in chopping wood. It just feels like a more dangerous activity.
It feels more dangerous.
Yeah, it's a dangerous act. It's a dangerous act.
A date killing someone is far-fetched.
That's a heavy date.
Is that a Yiddish word for fetched? Far-fetched. Yeah. That's Simon Sharma's joke. I can't take credit for that. Interesting. I mean, date trees can be very tall. Dates can be... I mean, yeah, we may not... I live thinking that...
One date is a far-fetched example, and that's the whole point.
Go on.
The whole point is that it's a far-fetched example that no one would predict and no one would expect.
But you all seem kind of instinctively to feel... A date falling and killing someone for me throwing earth is far less likely. Okay, interesting. You could measure that. You wouldn't think it's less likely?
No, you would. If someone throws some mud at a tree that causes it, that's even more...
I think we're probably all like envisioning our backyard with like our earth and our trees, but it's possible to concoct a circumstance where... you ever lift up a pineapple? Or watermelon? You ever lift up a watermelon? So a clump of dates doesn't have to be like three dates like in the supermarket. We're talking about, let's say, a watermelon tree that's 50 foot up and it falls down. I think we're all like, oh, yeah, that'd kill me. That'd take my head off.
Coconuts.
So we also think, oh, coconut's very light. But if you've got like 25 of them and it's 50 feet, it can do quite some damage. So let's take for granted it can kill someone. And how can I take that for granted? Because it kills someone. That's what we're told. The case is it killed someone. So it's clearly capable of it. So you're right, instinctively we feel it separate, and what the suggestion is going to be, well, maybe that instinct is because I threw it, and I've gone on my walk now. 10 minutes later, when it reaches 50 feet high, something happens. When I'm holding, it's instantaneous, that splinter flies off. It's like connected to what I'm holding. I'm holding an axe, and I kind of splinter it off. It's like it's coming from me. If I throw it up, I'm no longer involved in what's going on. It hits something, it's what it's going to do with me. So there is an instinctive sense that it's more remote, less direct. So that's why the Rabbanan say pshita. So the rabbis don't have any of our instincts and say, obviously that's the same case. Where it's the same, you've done something, there's a consequence and someone's dead. Obviously it's the same. So Rav Papa responds, said, Maudetem, you might have thought, kokoa koko dami, that it is a secondary impact because you threw something, you're not involved anymore, and then something happened, you might think it's remote. And I should note, there are many halachic applications of this principle in different contexts that we're not going to talk much length about, which is, for example, in Shechita. Shechita requires you to do the act. Rabbi Leibowitz spoke about this at some point, Rav Aryeh Leibowitz. But if I throw a knife, and I'm an excellent aimer, and it happens to cut the throat in exactly the right place on an animal... Is that kosher shechita? Or do I have to be holding the knife? So it turns out you don't have to be holding it. It just has to be your koach. It has to be your power. So as long as you throw it and it works, that's good. What happens if I throw it, and like on the YouTube video, it ricochets off four angles and then hits the cow. I mean, the cow obviously is me like, what are you doing to me? But say again. Right, you intended it. You say, I'm an expert thrower, I'm intending clash, clash, boom, boom, ricochet, killed. So is it koach, kocho? Is it kind of, it's now the wall has participated because it didn't just come from me. It's come from other energies too. So there's a debate about whether that works. So it is conceptually a relevant distinction. But here, Rav Papa is saying that distinction doesn't apply. It's just an unintended consequence. It's not that it came from you. Again, the violation when it comes to issues of shogeg is not necessarily a physical violation. It is a violation of intent. It is a breach of contract. What did I fail to do? Let's put it this way. If I throw something at a tree and it falls and kills someone, my crime, what was the crime?
That you weren't careful enough.
Right. The crime was not that I threw the earth. It was not a crime of act. It was a mental crime that I didn't pay enough attention before I threw it. That's the problem.
But who circumscribes the degree of care? So, for example, we're living in an era now of, let's say, woke culture, which is super sensitized to a lot of things. So to what degree? And like, say, American jurisprudence, I mean, because of the way the courts have things, you know, you walk on a floor that's been mopped. If you don't put that yellow thing on that says wet floors, because there's concepts of contributory negligence, to what degree is your act considered contributing to that negligence?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we mentioned last week that there's a microwave company, someone speaking about it, says on the box when you buy it, do not put cats in the microwave. And the reason is because somebody once had a wet cat and dried it off by putting it in the microwave.
And they probably had to get...
And they sued the company.
Yeah.
Right, so the company now...
put that hot coffee between their legs from McDonald's, you know that
right,
story.
Right, so it says caution hot on the hot coffee cup. Yeah, so, I mean, the question I would... The answer would be you'd have to take it to Basin and they'd adjudicate because we don't have, like, a fine print. But in the Mishnah that we're about to read, it'll start getting in this direction. How liable are you, to what degree? And there's going to be back and forth among the sages. So we'll come... to entertain this. So, Kamash Malan, first word on the line is Detema. So the Gemara says, hold on a minute. Is there any time where unintended consequences are too far then? If you've now said that for Rebbe, even if I throw a clod of earth and I've closed my eyes, I walked away, and that as a response, something fell and killed someone, you know, how woke is Rebbe is the question. How attentive do you have to be to unintended conduct? Like, I didn't mean it. It's like, it doesn't matter, you did it. Is there any way where it could be far removed enough? So this is going to be the case. Kagon, for example, Deshada Pisa Umachaya Lagarma. You threw a clod of earth and it hit a branch. Vazil Garma Mechalachavcha. The branch fell, sounds like... what are we seeing on Seder night? Chagaja, there you go. You hit a branch, and the branch fell, and it hit the dates. And then the dates fell, vata tamre, it severed the dates, vazel tamre v'kassel, and then the dates killed someone. That's a case where Rebbe would say, you don't have to go to Gullus. So there is a line. What's the line? Is it like, I did something, something did something, and something did something? That's the line. It's got to be like a three-phase. Sounds like it. For Rebbe, that would be the case. It's not particularly pertinent what the rule is or the line is. We're just noting there is a line. Where Rebbe would say, it can't be I threw earth and it hit something and then knocked a car and it did this and it did that and then you're in trouble. There is a way we have to say that you can't be expected to be hypersensitive for Rebbe to everything. Mishnah. So now we're getting into the Mishnah, which is going to, I think, prove or at least accentuate how much manslaughter is not a metaphysical crime. And again, I've been trying very hard to think about how to formulate this. Manslaughter is not about the harm that you do. It is about the lack of attention that you pay to people you have guaranteed that you will pay attention. And this is where it'll become clear. And in a minute, we'll get to a point where in the next mission, it'll sound almost xenophobic. Because we'll get to a point where manslaughter against a non-Jew doesn't count. Which sounds like, oh, their lives are less valuable because... killing a Jew by accident, you're in trouble. Killing a non-Jew by accident, you're not in trouble. But if the premise is this is about social contract, and non-Jews in Jewish political philosophy are meaning non-citizens, I don't have a social contract with non-citizens in the same way I do with people who share my body politic. in the same way that if someone doesn't have permission to me in my backyard, I don't have a social contract with them. It's not their life is worth any less. I just didn't make an implicit agreement that they can be here. Yeah.
Is there a law that damn for non-Jews?
So the answer is no, but I don't think we're even going to talk about it. Well, we've spoken about it. So I don't think it's going to come up. But there will be various citizens in between. I mean, put it this way. A non-citizen who is not legally permitted here, I don't have a social contract with. Again, I can't murder them. But if I kill them by mistake, I don't go to Gullis. I don't have a social contract with them. What about a resident alien? What about someone on an H-1 visa? Do I have a social contract with them?
Yes.
Right. I have somewhat of a social contract with them. And the question is going to be, does that social contract mean that I've agreed to pay attention to them in the same way as every other citizen? Or is there a gradation there? And that's going to be part of the debate that unfolds. So, Mishta. Hazarik Evan Larishas Arabim. If you go into Times Square and you start throwing knives, and you're not aiming for anybody, you're just throwing knives. I didn't mean it. I'm practicing my knife throwing. Vahareg, and somebody dies, Harizeh Gola, you go to Golas. Any responses to that? Any thoughts about that? Does that make sense? You can say it's negligence.
That's murder. That's slaughter.
Right, so that's the Gemara. If you look in the green, Larisha the Rabbi, amazing. What are you talking about? You went to Times Square, you start throwing knives? That seems pretty intentional to me. Yeah, you didn't actually want that person to die. This is insane. So we're going to have to detail what exactly that case is, but that's the opening of the Mishnah. If you throw things at Larisha the Rabbi and someone dies, that's considered negligence. And the case of the Gemara is going to say, oh, that's talking about a very specific case, incredibly limited. Somebody is relieving themselves in a dump next to your house that is designed for people to relieve themselves at night. And you push your wall over during the day and it squashes them. That's the only case. So what you're seeing is it possible that the author of this Mishnah was being kind of generic and said, no, and Rishas HaRabim when you throw things. I mean, they weren't thinking of Times Square. They were thinking of a marketplace where four people would walk at the period of the day. And the Gemara is living in an age where marketplaces are busier or they're entertaining the consequence. We need to limit what is meant conceptually by that statement. You can't just go into Times Square and start throwing knives. So it must be talking about a very narrow case, which doesn't mean the Mishnah meant that when it said that. Conceptually, that's what the Mishnah was referring to, that level of intent, that level of negligence. So let's go through. Rav Elazar ben Yaakov says, and this is a helpful case. Let's say you're in Times Square and you're looking around and it's middle of COVID, completely empty. No one's there. And you say, I've been waiting for this day. I've been wanting to practice my knife throwing in Times Square my whole life. No one's here. And you start throwing knives. And then that, you know, that little stand, I think it's an army recruitment or is it police recruitment stand in the middle? And you're throwing knives and then you throw it and you go, oh, this is a 50-foot one. It's going to go, and it starts flying. And then one of the recruiters goes, hello? And it hits him in the face. So that's obviously a crazy case. But his head wasn't there when I threw it. I was paying attention, and I made sure no one was there. Is that negligence? So Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is going to disagree. And he's going to say, based on the verse, and he's not going to say, I feel this instinctively. He's saying, based on the verse, you're only held liable to pay attention to what happens at the moment you do your act. But if I start throwing things and then somebody kind of puts their head out, and the phrase is an odd formulation. He says, the first one line is Omer, Im koshiyasta ha'evan miyado. If once the stone leaves your hand that you're throwing, hotzi hala is going. It rasho, and this person puts his head out, v'kabla. V'kabla means, and he catches it, or he receives it with his face. Harizeh patur, you are exempt. Again, this is not onus. It's not like I had no conceivable idea this could possibly happen. But it's not negligence. So you don't go to, we can't take you to court and hold you liable. You should not be doing this, but you're not going to exile. Zara geta evin lachatzera. What happens if you've got your own courtyard and you're doing stone throwing practice in your own courtyard? Any of you ever done shot put? Anyone ever heard of shot put?
Yeah.
Familiar with shot put? Yes, it was my favorite sport in high school. You don't have to move very much. So maybe that's why you're throwing stones in your own courtyard. And it kills somebody. If the person who got killed had permission to be there, meaning they were an invited guest, and to make it sound a little more negligent. I mean, if I invite you to my house for lunch and I start throwing stones around and it hits you, that sounds like mazed to me. Like, I just invited you. You're sitting in my house. So you have to imagine I've got a neighbor who I say to my neighbor, you know what? Feel free to come anytime you like. You've got permission to come in whenever you want. So I don't know that you're in my house right now. I just know you have permission. I have an implicit social contract with you. You can be in this space. And I'm throwing shot puts, and then it kills you. If you had permission to be there, I go to Gullus. In love, ain't no Gullus. If you had no permission to be there, I don't go to Gullus. And this, for me, again, the level of negligence is the same. I was not paying attention. A human being ended up being there and got killed. It wasn't like I paid more attention or less attention whether you had permission to be there. I just got lucky in the case that you had no permission to be there, that my negligence didn't hurt someone who was allowed to be there. So this is a social crime. My mental state was exactly the same. I was throwing, I was being unattentive, and someone died. You're welcome to push back if you think that there's another way to conceptualize this. But that's what it seems to be to me. Yeah.
I don't know. If you have the intention, you know your house is open to everybody. Your intention, you have to be careful if you don't let anybody come in. So I think that is intention. It's
yeah.
A public place.
So this is what this is the kind of the gray area I was thinking, and that's why I made it hard to articulate. Meaning, you could say, if I know that people are allowed to come in to my backyard because I've told them to come in, I automatically have to pay more attention. What happens if I know that someone can come in at any time and I throw shot puts and it kills someone who didn't have permission to be there? I already know that someone could be here, right? I gave somebody permission. I just got lucky you're not that person. So it seems to be the level of negligence isn't what's at stake, because I expressed, I know anyone could come into my backyard at any time because I told three people they got permission. Happens to be the person who I hurt was not one of the people I gave permission to. But I should have been paying attention because I know people can be here.
But it's saying that the other person, the social contract,
yeah,
other people also have a social contract. If they're not where they're supposed to be, it's their fault too.
That's right.
So
you're right, but my level of negligence isn't less. So it's not...
Social contract.
Correct. What? So this is a social crime. It's not a crime of harm.
It's tempered by the fact that the other person has some responsibility too.
Exactly.
So right, but their level of responsibility shouldn't impact my negligence or my level of negligence.
I think it does, because there's a mutuality. I mean, in other words, when you drive a car, you're making certain assumptions about what the person in front of you is going to do. If they don't, so there's this social contract that you all have, that everybody kind of doing what they're supposed to do. You're going to stay in your lane, I'm going to stay in my lane, you turn on the signal, now I know. So it's a balance. It's like the, you know, the orbit of the planets. They all, so the minute they violate something, you violate something, it's not all on you.
What about you have an intruder on your flat roof without a fence and they fall off? Aren't you responsible?
Right, so that would be, I guess, interesting.
They have a social contract, but they shouldn't be on your roof?
Right, they shouldn't be there and you're held responsible for that. I guess that's interesting, because that's a specific obligation to make your house a safe place, and it's not about an act I did. Right.
Like, say you give like three people over, like whoever, you give people over shifts to be in your backyard, but you know that they're not in town. So then you know you can start throwing knives, and somebody else walks in, and like, but you knew, you did give people permission to be in your backyard, but you know those certain people you give permission to. Not there.
So I'd say that would be the equivalent of a case where I've given no one permission to be in my backyard. And you're right. If there was a case where I said, this is my, you know, shot put range, no one, not my wife, not my kids, no one is allowed to be in this place apart from me. I got free range to throw whatever I want. And someone's in there. Then I can see, yeah, that is about awareness. I don't have to have any awareness here. But so we can design very specific cases that seem to emphasize one or the other. But this is generic. The only condition is, do you have permission to be there or not? So it sounds like this is a place where some people have permission, some people don't. And if I hurt you, it depends whether you're allowed to be there. So it is about a social contract, but it's not about my level of intention. Meaning, again, I'm going to use the most generic case. Three people I've given permission to be in my backyard whenever they want. I start throwing things. I should be paying attention because I know three people could be there. Turns out the person who ends up being there had no permission and they get hurt. I'm not in trouble. But I had no way to know that they weren't those three people, because I'm not given the stipulation that I know they're out of town. So it sounds like there's an implicit contract I have with particular people to be attentive to them. So my intention for them would have been problematic. It's negligent concerning them. But if you had no permission to be here, I made no agreement with you that I would be sensitive and attentive to your presence here. So even though you're right, my level of negligence was the same. I was unattentive to other people. I didn't agree with you to pay attention to you. Does that make sense?
So would your concern be addressed if, let's say, I gave permission to three people to come, and now I want to start practicing my flame throwing, so I put up a sign outside that says, to all those who I previously gave permission, just know now I am flame throwing.
Right. Meaning I've... So that would be an interesting question. You bring that to Basted, meaning, so I gave a warning. That's my way of paying attention.
I paid attention.
And this is my... I mean, and it's the implication of that. Don't come in.
I revoke my permission for the next hour.
Yes, if you say no one has permission for the next hour, right. I was being negligent in the sense that I was throwing flames irrespective of whether people are there, but I told no one to be here.
Yeah, but I didn't see the sign. I went through the front door and you put it on the back.
Text message.
Right, so you put it on WhatsApp. No, you're right. So this would be a case that would have to come to Basin and have to adjudicate what is at stake here. Is it that you've made an agreement to pay attention? Is it because of the agreement you're by definition paying less attention? It seems to me a mix, yeah.
I also think that when you know somebody knows somebody, they know this guy throws knives.
He gave me permission, but I'm not going anywhere near his house,
no,
right?
You know, you go through the front door, not the back door. You know what, you know, like good friends you give the permission to, they know what you're about.
Right.
The stranger has no idea.
So I think these questions illustrate exactly the purposeful gaps that is in the Mishnah and the Gemara. Where it doesn't say, we have the reputation of the Gemara going into the details and the weeds, but it doesn't give every instance because it's just trying to provide concepts. And when he gives crazy cases like you throw a lump of earth through a date falls, it's to illustrate a particular concept. So if you have a particular case and you come to court, you can say, well, I put a sign up. Say, well, they went through the other door, but they know that you never go through that door. And then the basin would have to talk about, okay, what are your levels of intent? How do we adjudicate this case? Excellent. So he actually proves this from a verse. He says, it depends whether you have permission. Shneemar, as it says, and what we're going to see in a minute, is the implications of this verse are even broader. Shneemar is the first word in line. V'asher yavo et re'u b'yar. If, v'asher, and if yavo et re'u b'yar, you come into the forest with a friend of yours and you start chopping wood and it kills them. That's the case, the classic case given in the Sukkim. If you're in the forest chopping wood and someone dies by mistake, you have to go to exile. So, ma yahayar reshut l'nizag l'mazik l'kanes l'sham. The Mishnah says, the example in the Psukim is you're in the forest. Who's got permission to be in the forest?
Everyone.
So it's talking about grounds where both people had the permission to be there. Af kol reshut l'nizik l'mazik l'sham. So it has to be, this only applies, this penalty of going to exile if everybody had permission to be there. So there is an interesting question the Gemara doesn't deal with that I'll just raise so that, you know, oh, if this comes up, we'd have to take it to court. What happens if I was in someone's garden, I did not have permission to be there, and I killed them by mistake? It was negligent. I was knife throwing, but it wasn't that I was the victim and didn't have permission to be there. I was the perpetrator and I didn't have permission to be there. So is it Karav Lamezid? Or is it just...
So you trespassed and you killed somebody?
Yeah.
Oh, you're going away forever.
Right, but so is it Mezid? Maybe. But let's say... Right, it's not me. I mean, I didn't want to... I just wanted... I love this shot put range. I want to practice my shot put. I can't afford my own range. I came to practice. Oops, the guy came and I killed him. So it's shogeg technique. You can say it's mazed because it's not your place. So it's karov lemazed. So that's where I think we'd end up. But that's the case. One's if two people love the shot put range, who neither of them have permission to be there, and they both go to go practice one night, and one of them kills the other. Neither have permission to be there. So it's not the classic case of the Gemara, or the Psukim, rather. So these are just implications. Now, is chopping wood in the forest an obligation? Generally, is it a mitzvah to chop wood in the forest?
Depends what the use of the wood is. Yeah.
Does it depend what the use of the wood is? Give me an example, chopping wood being a mitzvah.
Your father asked you to.
Your father asked you to? Interesting. What happens if your father... Meaning, what did your father tell you to do?
Go chop wood.
Right, I was going to say, if he said, get me some wood, then chopping wood's not the mitzvah. If I found wood, I'd just bring you wood. But if he said no, chop wood. Why? Because I like the sound of you chopping wood. So let's say I found wood then. So the chopping isn't the mitzvah.
Usually, but wood is from a tree, so you know it's not norm.
So this is going
to... wood just laying there, you have to chop it down.
So this is going to be part of the question. Let's say I'm chopping wood to build a sukkah. Or I'm chopping wood because you have to have the ma'aracha, the wood panel in the Bet Mikdash was there to use wood. So let's say that's why I'm chopping wood. So Rava's going to say, well, if you had found wood, you wouldn't have to chop it. So the chopping isn't a mitzvah. In this case, you needed it. That's what it sounds like. But chopping wood, so if that's true, is chopping wood by definition ever a mitzvah? I mean, I think Jay may have hit the kind of one case where, like, if your father told you you have to chop wood and said, I don't want you to record the sound because I don't like the sound. I don't want you to get wood for heat. I want to see you chopping wood because it makes me feel like my son is a man. So you go and you chop wood and that's what I want. I guess that would be a case where it would be a mitzvah. Maybe not. Do you have to do everything your parents say?
No.
Well, what are the exceptions?
If you chop wood, you should chop wood.
Is this from experience? You're still waiting? Interesting. I mean, if they said break Shabbos, you don't break Shabbos. So perhaps definitionally, parental instructions are not inchoate commands. Taken into the broad context, I am allowed to use my sense. So if your father said to you, you need to chop wood right now because that's what I want to see, could you say, no? I mean, why? Right, so if it's Shabbos, you say, I can't do that. So it's clearly not binding in the same way. If you have divorced parents and your mother asks you not to chop wood and your father asks you to chop wood, what do you do?
See a
therapist. I mean, that's basically what the Gemara in Kiddushin says. The Gemara in Kiddushin says, if your mother and father ask you for a glass of water, who'd you get first? That's what the Gemara says. And the Gemara says you should get for your father first because within the hierarchy of the house, the wife has obligations to look after the husband as well. So her obligations become subsidiary. That's what. So the Gemara says, okay, what about, I didn't mean to cause any issues there. So imagine they're now divorced. She's got no obligations to him, and you've got obligations equal to both, mother and father. And the Gemara says, so just put a glass of water in the middle and let them fight over who gets it. That's what they said. Look, I don't know. So the commands are not like inchoate, so you have to use your seichel a little bit. So it could be, you could say, it's not a mitzvah to chop wood because he told me to. It's a mitzvah to listen to my father. And if there was another way, if I could convince my father that I don't need to chop wood to get their approval, or I'm manly enough without chopping wood, I wouldn't have to. So the chopping is not actually a mitzvah. So maybe there's a way to deny that too. So Abba Shaul, this is the pink in that mishnah, Abba Shaul says, Omer macha tavat eitzim reshut. Just as chopping wood is always reshut. And the Gemara is going to say, is it always reshut? We've got all these cases. But he's taken for granted. Chopping wood is not a mitzvah ever. Af kol reshut. The only time you can go to galus, where negligence counts, where you have a social contract to pay attention, is when what you're doing is a voluntary act. Think of a case where you're doing a mitzvah and somebody gets hurt. Someone give me a case where you're doing a mitzvah. It is a mitzvah to do something that might be dangerous. We said chopping wood never is a mitzvah. Give me an example of a mitzvah where it might be dangerous, but you have to do it.
Shchita.
Say again?
Shchita, you have to do it.
Shchita, okay, so shchita, good. Shchita, you don't have to, right? Meaning there's no obligation for me to...
Sometimes it's an obligation for
a carbon. Interesting, you're doing shchita in the Bet Mikdash for a chatat that someone had to do. I guess that might be an interesting case.
But you don't do shchita, do you?
In theory, the owner might be able to do shchita. Correct. Yeah, the Kohen could do it, I guess. Go on, Debbie. Go on, Debbie. So. Marker?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
So the gate could fall from a height.
Right.
You're putting it. You have an obligation to put it up.
Okay, interesting. You're building a marker and it fell off. That's a good
you
case.
You have the expectation that people could be walking around.
Okay, interesting. So
well,
the
building a sukkah and you have one of those.
Is it a mitzvah to build a sukkah? Or is it a mitzvah to sit in a sukkah on sukkahs? So, I mean, now that you've said market, maybe I'll push back. It is a mitzvah to build a market, or is it a mitzvah to have a market if you don't have one? Meaning, if I don't have a flat roof. Right, so if I don't have a gag, if I don't have a flat roof, I don't have a mitzvah to build a flat roof so I can put a marker there. These are all responses to situations. And I can see we're going to not do both sides of the summer today, so apologies. But when is there an obligation that I have to do something under all circumstances? It's a mitzvah to do it. It's not just if this happens. Say again?
Bris.
Oh, bris. Interesting. So if I have to do a bris, it's a mitzvah to do that, and somebody dies as a result. Meaning, as I chop, the axe handle flies off. Why am I using an axe? The fall, well, hopefully, well, maybe not flies off, but yeah, that's probably not going to kill anybody. But you do that, someone standing too close lands in their throat, they choke to death. I don't know, all sorts of situations you could imagine. Interesting. So the Gemara is going to pick a more common, I guess, scenario, at least as it was back in the day, which is, and you could tell me whether you had this experience at school, being caned by a teacher. You had that at school?
I did, fourth grade.
Really? Was it legal? Was it legal at the time?
He's an old school rabbi.
No.
My father, he used to get, he got kicked by teachers, but I also don't think it was illegal. I don't think it was legal. Right, I got dragged out of a room by the scruff of my neck, and there was a teacher who would wield a yardstick. He wouldn't use it. Right, but my grandfather, he got caned at school. And it was legal. There would be an official cane, and you'd have to line up and put your hand out, and you'd get caned in the hand. They published What's Acceptable Punishment in British Schools about 5 years ago. And cane did not make the list. Weeding the playground, that was acceptable. If kids misbehaved, to make them pull the weeds out in the playground. That was acceptable form of punishment. But corporal punishment is not. But at least back in the day, corporal punishment was seen as not just legal, but considered a mitzvah, at which point, what might you respond? Meaning we said building a sukkah is not a mitzvah because if you happen to have a sukkah there, you don't have to build it. So is there any case where hitting a child would not be a mitzvah? And I say this as a responsible parent. Is there any time where hitting a child would not be a mitzvah? If they didn't do anything wrong, they're well behaved. So Rav is going to say, nah, it's always a mitzvah to hit kids. Which gets some of the commentaries into hot water. So Abishal Omer, Abishal says, Machat David Eitzim Meshudav, Kol Meshud, it's only voluntary cases. You can go to negligence cares. And this again demonstrates the whole thrust of this Mishnah is, your level of negligence is only part of the picture when it comes to you going to Galus. There has to be an implicit commitment that I will pay attention to you in this context. You either have to have permission to be here, or if you've got ha'ava market beno, for father striking a child, v'haravo de talmida. Now, is it legal for parents to hit children for punishment purposes? I don't mean like abusive punishment. Are parents allowed to? You hope so. I'm pretty sure they changed the rules on this, and social services might be able to intervene. I might be wrong, but yeah, I am right. Right. So I know at least, and this was hopefully not a long time ago, but growing up, I don't think that was the case. I mean, not getting anybody in trouble, I may have occasionally got hit intentionally as a means of discipline. I told Miriam that, and she was horrified. I was hitting my children at the time. So I don't do that, but I think the rules have changed on that. But the assumption is hitting a kid as a form of discipline was considered to be a duty of a parent. V'harava rode et talmido, or a teacher that is striking their kid, or a case that I think hopefully everybody can agree, even today in what John has called a woke culture, we'd agree somebody has permission to carry out violence in this context, considering that it's legal in certain cases, is the shliach beis din, or the executioner. Meaning, there are not really corporal punishments in the United States today, with one exception, which is, what corporal punishment? Or no, what's the punishment, not the crime? So prison is not really a corporal punishment, it's a spatial, you get exiled, but what in terms of physical harm? There's no whipping, it's just death, right? It's just execution, it's the only one. So who does the execution?
An executioner.
There's some person who has to either give the jab or pull the lever, there's someone who does, they're committing violence, but it's a duty. So not in the case of death, in the case of lashes, if there's the court executioner or the court punisher comes along and starts whipping someone because they've got a duty to give them lashes, but they're getting 29. That's what the doctor said they could get, and they give them 29, and they die as a result. So maybe I was too hard, I got too excited with my lashes, but it was my duty to hit them. So it seems to be, it doesn't matter whether you were negligent. If you did it intentionally to kill them, if you were negligent, it doesn't matter if you had a duty. So that's what Abishol says. All comes from the verse that if you're in the forest, meaning everyone's got permission to be here, it's a voluntary act, there are implicit commitments, meaning if you have a mandate, your negligence doesn't matter. If a father is hitting a child, and strictly speaking, they should have been careful not to hit that hard. I didn't mean to hurt them. I didn't mean to kill them. I just wanted them to behave, and it ended up hurting them to the point where they died. It seems to be you would not go to Gullus because the fact that you have a mandate to smite them overrules your negligence. Again, we're not talking in contemporary terms what's permissible for parents to do, even in Jewish law, but that's where it is. So let's do another few minutes. L'rishla Rabbi Mezidu, the Gemara says, hold on a minute. The beginning of this Mishnah, I don't know why this was so dense. I made it dense, I think. If you throw a stone at Rishon Rabbim, the Mishnah says, that's negligence. The Gemara says, whoa. Mezidu, that's close to intentional. Amar Shmur Yizcha, Besodek Kodesh. It's talking about a case where you didn't throw stones in public. You were demolishing your wall. It's your wall, your permission to demolish it. Ibai Leli Yune, you should look on the other side of the wall if you're demolishing a wall. If your wall goes onto a public space, you can't just push your wall over and say, it's my wall. So you've got to think about who's on the other side. Besodek Kodesh Belaila. Oh, you were pushing it down at night. And what you can see, the Gemara could just jump to the bottom line here, but it's pushing the gradations here. How much attention do you have to pay? It's nighttime. I didn't expect anyone to be there. The Gemara is going to say, Balayla, name ibai leilu yune. You have a social contract at night. It's a public space. You've got a contract that anyone has permission to be there at any time. You need to pay attention. But so that Kota La Ashpa says, oh, you don't go into like Times Square. Is there like a city municipal dump somewhere? Does it exist? I think they were just talking about the whole borough. Interesting. Right, so growing up, we had a place called the local dump, where if you wanted to throw like a television or something big out and it can't fit like on the curb, you'd drive and you'd be a drive-through and you'd push massive in. They did a massive dump. That was one of my weekly trips with my father. We're going to the dump. Okay. But they don't have that. They've got like big pickup day or something here where you can leave things on the curb. So, hi, Ashba. So, this dump you're talking about, you're pushing your wall onto, Heichidami, what's the case? If a lot of people are in the dump, meaning if the homeless crisis has got so bad that a lot of people are living in the municipal dump, you know people are there. So it doesn't matter what it is if people are there. But if no one goes to this dump, it's like sealed in and no one really goes there, it's onus, it's an accident. Very specific case where the Mishnah sounded incredibly broad. We're talking about a case where it's a kind of dump where people can go to relieve themselves at night. And it's not really got privacy. It's not really designed for people to relieve themselves during the day. But it happens that people do on occasion. So this is a very specific case where it's a nighttime relief spot for the homeless. But during the day, it's accessible, but people don't really go there very much. Poshelo Havi, it's not considered intentional because you know no one really comes here during the day. Because people don't go there. Ones Namila Havi, but it's also not an accident. Because people do go to sit there. So you have an obligation to look. So it's not Karav Lamezid, but it is absolute negligence. Full stop. Very specific case. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Omer. Yaakov ben Elazar says, Tana Rabbana, and the rabbis talk to Matzah Prat Lamamtit Atzmo. Says, you're in the forest and you're chopping matzah and the wood finds somebody and it kills them. Prat lamamtzit atzma, that excludes somebody who themselves found your splinter, meaning they stuck their head out after the splinter started flying. Mikanam Rablazam imshiasta evim yado hitzihalat roshu. This is where Rablazam ben Yaakov says, if you threw the stone and then after it started flying, someone stuck their head out of a kabla and it hits him in the face, pater, you're pater. Lamemra, the Gemara is now going to try and understand the word matzah. To matzah, you're telling me because the verse says it found their head, mi'ikara mashma, that sounds like it only found the head that was already there. that you are only liable to pay attention to the scene. You can't anticipate the future. You only have to look around you at the time when you throw. Verminu, but we've got a contradiction. Matza pratla matsui. There is another case where the word matza is used that says you have to pay attention not only to what's happening right now, but to what's going to happen in the future. This is a case, if I have an ancestral land. Anyone ever been to Rhode Island, Providence? What's the place where all the massive big properties, like the Breakers?
Newport,
where they had all the, when was it, in the Golden Age, whatever it was called? The which one? The Gilded Age, thank you. So you had all these families with these massive properties who are now bankrupt. And at some point, they couldn't really afford to maintain these properties. They're owned by museums now who kind of keep the properties there for tourists. So let's say you're part of the Rockefeller dynasty. You've got no money left. You've got this ancestral property, and you're forced to sell it. By Jewish law, if you've got ancestral land and you're forced to sell it and then you win the lottery, the buyers are legally obligated to sell it back to you if you now achieve money. Because ancestral land is important. I didn't have any money. I was forced to, but now I won the lottery. So you have to sell it back to me. So well, I just bought it. I just moved in. I've told all my friends that I don't care. Legally, you have to sell it back to me now. What happens if I owned the Breakers and I also owned like half of Staten Island? So, you know, it's not the same level quality land. And I said, I guess I'm forced to sell my Breakers because I need the money. And then I say, well, you know what? Now that I'm going to use Staten Island to buy it back. You could turn around as a buyer and say, but you had Staten Island at the same time. You didn't just win the lottery. You had that all along. You can't force me to pay it back. And that's what the Mishnah, that's what the Pasuk says. Umatza, if you suddenly found money, you can force them to sell it back. But that means you had to get it new. Matza means you found something new, not that you had at the time. So it sounds like matza means something you found new rather than you had at the time. So here where it says umatza and it found somebody's head, maybe it means it found a head out of nowhere rather than it was there initially. So the Gemara is going to dismiss this comparison. The Gemara uses this Mishnah to say the word matzah means when you find something new. Amar Rava, Hacha Minyana Dikra. Rava says that you have to look at each verse in context. Vata Minyana Dikra. Every verse, the word matzah means something different in context. Hata Minyana Dikra. Matzah Dumi Devasiga Yago. Yado. There when it says, and you find and you can afford, it's clearly talking about you discovered new money or you won the lottery. Maasigya de Mahashta. Af Matzah Nami Mahashta. So suddenly you've discovered money and you can afford it. That's what the word matzah means. Hacha Minyana Dikra here. Matzah Dumi Diyar. It's talking about when you find in the context of going into a forest. Ma yar midi de ichi miyakara, af matzah nami yakara, full stop. The context is exactly what the Mishnah said. If you throw a stone and it hits somebody in the head who said was not there when you threw the stone, you are not liable. We'll do a couple more sentences and then we'll wrap for today. Hazarika de Evan. So this was our case that became very complicated. You throw a stone, the Mishnah said. It all depends whether they've got permission to be there or not. How do I know? So the rabbis asked Rava this question. What was, anyone remember the basis that we know everything has to be only if you've got permission to do what you're doing? Only if you did what you're doing because you volunteered to do it. You're chopping wood is a voluntary case. So only if you're doing a voluntary thing and someone dies, is it a problem? Mimai, how do I know? Demechatavid eitzim derashus, because the Mishnah assumes chopping wood is always a voluntary act. So if I'm doing my duty and someone dies, I'm not liable. But dilma mechatavid eitzim desuka, umechatavid eitzim demaracha. Maybe sometimes chopping wood is a mitzvah. Viluhachi amrachman eligli. Meaning the case that the tzukim give, you are chopping wood in a forest and someone dies, you have to go to galus. So the Mishnah said, oh, you're chopping wood in a forest. It sounds like it's only talking about a voluntary case. So the Gemara says, no, there are times where maybe it's a duty to cut wood. You're building a sukkah. You're listening to your father. You're building a, you're chopping wood for a ma'akeh. You're chopping wood sometimes can be a mitzvah. Yeah.
You said that making the sukkah is not a mitzvah. So why
that's where he's going to push back. He's about to say that. Right. Meaning at this moment, there's an assumption. If you're chopping wood for the sake of a mitzvah, it's a mitzvah. You don't have any wood. You need to sit in a sukkah. It's a mitzvah to do it. So maybe that's the case. Amalei Rava responded, Kivin de matzah chatev, if you had found chopped wood, love mitzvah, there'd be no obligation to cut wood. Hashtanami love mitzvah. So there's no mitzvah In any case, to chop wood, it is what we call a hechsher mitzvah. It's facilitating a mitzvah, but there's no obligation to cut wood. Eitve Ravina LaRava. Ravina says to Rava, oh, now that you've said that, Yatza Avamaket Benova, Rav wrote it, Talmidu Shlech Beistin, the Mishnah's exact examples of cases of mitzvah, was a parent hitting a child, or a teacher striking a student, or an agent of the court carrying out punishment. Lema kiven de'ilu gemir, but if the student had been a good student, or if this criminal hadn't committed a crime, there's no obligation for the agent of the court to go around punishing people. If everybody was great, there'd be no need for punishment. Love mitzvah, ashtu nami love mitzvah, there should never be a mitzvah. Hatam, in that case where the father or the student or the teacher is striking a child, afal gav gemir mitzvah, even if the student is well behaved, there's an obligation to hit that child. Anyone have teachers with that policy?
Yeah?
There you go. What's the English turn of phrase? Spare the rod, spoil the child. Give him a good whipping every so often. Indeed. Not indeed in agreement, but yes, that's the phrase. Dichtiv, but what's the proof? And again, I guess the proof is important for our purposes. This is a verse taken from Mishlei. Yasar bincha, if you chastise your child, v'nicheha, it will give you rest. And it will give great pleasures to your soul. What is the assumption here? Firstly, what is it suggesting? It doesn't say hit your child. It says yaser. It says chastise. So what does that mean? Chastise your child and it'll be good for them and be good for you. Right. So back in the day, it meant hit them. Is there a possibility that psychological science research training may show that hitting is not the best form of chastisement? Yeah. So is this a problem morally? It's a problem morally in the sense that we'd say, how could they do this to children? They didn't know. They thought that this was the best way to educate children. They didn't have longitudinal studies to see trauma over generations. Lifespans were shorter anyway. Hierarchies were different. People were under the thumb of their governmental authorities. The idea that hitting someone might hurt them. So I should treat my kid better than my government treats me. I mean, the whole system was different. In our age.
Rob spoke about how his father slapped him if he didn't know the Gemara.
Aha. Uh-huh. But he didn't slap his students. Right. So he didn't slap his students. Although anybody who... Right. Did he report it as, like, that was awful?
It was at his brother's funeral, at Shmuel's funeral. He said, my brother Shmuel was much smarter than me. He could have been a great Talmid Chacham. But when our father slapped us, he ran out of the room crying. But I was tough. I didn't give in. I stayed there.
Okay, interesting. Having said that, he didn't slap his students in Shir. As far as we know, and there were many students. Right, but his brother didn't.
Exactly.
Yeah, but his father was hitting both. The difference was his strength, not his father's attitude.
Made him stronger, according to the Rav, he said.
Right. No, but I'm saying, even according to the Rav, it made him stronger, but it made his brother weaker. So one had to be, I guess, discerning in how to chastise, which I guess is the point here. Which is the default that...
I could do it
again. Right, correct. But, right. But meaning hitting someone, even if we take the Rav's view as kind of an example, hitting someone by definition is not a good system. Trying to figure out what works for that child is a good system. And it could be the Rav would have been incredibly angry. Why didn't you slap me harder? It's like, oh, okay, I'm sorry. You know, if my biggest failing as a father is I didn't hit you hard enough. We're doing okay. But, you know, so you have to be very careful with what works for kids. But this is the point. Yaser bincha is... chastise, which doesn't mean slap or hit by definition, but it does mean that there should be a kind of disciplinary dynamic when it comes to rearing children or having students. And I agreed to do teaching for some middle school students over the past couple of months, which I have to say is very different to teaching college students. So it's beyond me why they asked college professors to come along and teach middle school students. Yeah, it could be that was why. Happens to be the institution has some sort of naivete about the capacity of human beings to be everybody like Plato. So they thought, oh, we've got the smartest middle school students. They're going to sit and you're just going to, it's going to be like Socrates' dialogue. Nope, that's not what it was like. And I think my, and it wasn't because of them, they're middle school, it's because of me. And my instinct is to try to be friendly with people, which in college tends to work because there's enough of an incentive for them to do well. They want to get a good grade. They're adults now. They want to learn something. Middle school kids, if you're friendly with them, they think, oh, I can toy around. And I remember when I was a kid, the best teachers we had, not the ones who were cruel and like would hit you. It's like you're just cruel. But the teachers who walked in, who you like sat up and you didn't speak unless you had something to say, and there was a set, those were the ones who you learned the most from, because there was a sense of you're in authority, you're not being punitive, but I have to revere you, and I'm going to do better that way. And that's the assumption here. So again, plug that into the ancient world or the rabbinic context, hitting a kid is a mitzvah. Plug that into our world, hitting children can be incredibly damaging. We've got scientific resources to back that up. And if Rava was here today, our assumption would be that he would be convinced by the evidence it's not a good idea to hit kids across the board. Maybe the Rav, you know, that would be a good example. He said maybe you should still do it if he thinks that's good for him. But if there's a way not to hit instead of chastise, that's what we ought to do. We're going to stop there. We'll pick up with Hada Amar Rava next time.
Rabbi, one question?
Yeah.
You had said about the doctorate that told the guy 29 lashes. And on the 29th lash, he died. Is the doctor held responsible at all?
Definitely not.
There you go. Yeah, good question. Seems not. All right, so we'll stop there. Next week we'll pick up and we'll forge ahead.
Rabbi, can I answer something?
Yeah.